Next week, we have no Sunday school because of the men's conference, and so we will reconvene in 2 weeks and talk about that other set of books called the Pseudepigrapha, which I just love to say. And if you have any of you had a chance to look at that website, Early Jewish Writings? Any of you? Okay, I would encourage you to do it just to look at the titles of some of these books that we're going to be discussing, because it's really it's interesting just to look at the titles and see. These are the books that we're talking about next time, remember, that it will say the Testament of Abraham, but it wasn't Abraham that wrote it. Or the story of Adam and Eve, but of course it wasn't Adam and Eve that wrote that either. Just a really interesting set of readings. What I wanted to do first is I want to have you turn in your Bibles, tablets, phones, whatever, to Matthew 22. And I want to thank Kim Foster for this, because this totally slipped my mind as I was talking last week about the book of Tobit. Tobit, if you recall, if you weren't here last week, I'll let you know. Tobit is one of these books about an old man who goes blind supernaturally. I won't repeat how. And there's another person far off who's also going through a similar discouraging time in their lives, and this angel, Raphael, intervenes in their lives. And this woman who was aided in the book of Tobit had been married 7 times, and each time this demon has killed her new husband on their wedding night. 7 times. And after I discussed that last week, Kim came up and showed me this passage in Matthew 22, and we'll start at verse 23. Matthew 22, 23. On that day, some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and questioned him, asking, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother as next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother. Now there were 7 brothers with us, and the first married and died, and having no children, left his wife to his brother. So also the second and the third, down to the 7th. Last of all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife of the 7 will she be? For they all had married her." I love it when Sadducees and Pharisees try to trick Jesus. But not that part, but what always happens afterwards is when he turns the tables on them. It's just so beautiful to see. But for this point, it's Jesus' answer. Jesus answered and said to them, "You are mistaken, not understanding the scriptures nor the power of God, for in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. When the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered themselves together. It's like, okay, the Sadducees weren't able to do it, so we will one up the Sadducees and trick Jesus up at the same time. But the point here, the question is this a reference to Tobit? Because it talks about someone having 7, how is it exactly phrased here? The 7th, 7 brothers. I start wanting to sing Broadway songs now. Says, "Bless your beautiful hide." So, talking about Tobit, and is it considered scriptural? And here Jesus says, "You are mistaken, not understanding the scriptures." So it seems in this particular passage that Jesus is discounting Tobit as being scripture. You can look at it that way. And so I want to thank Kim for pointing that out to me. That's Matthew chapter 22. I have here in your handout, for the first bullet point, I have this week's headlines. And again, every time I teach on a particular topic, something newsworthy happens. And I found something, again, this was dated back in September, but they updated the story this past week. And it's just amazing how these things happen. There's a lot going on right now with archaeology in the Middle East, in the Holy Land, and particularly pertaining to the Dead Sea Scrolls. Modern technology unlocks the secrets of a damaged biblical scroll. And here you can see this is a penny, just to give you some idea of the size of this little fragment. But what they have done now, is that some of these ancient scrolls that they find are so brittle that they cannot even unroll them in order to decipher them. Well, now they have a technology where they can decode what's in them without having to roll them out. And I want to read from part of this here. Just such a technology has now been perfected by computer scientists at the University of Kentucky, working with biblical scholars in Jerusalem. They have used a computer to unfurl a digital image of the scroll. It turns out to hold a fragment identical to the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible, and at nearly 2,000 years old is the earliest instance of the text. And they found this just last year. And, you know, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, there were some minor differences in their translation to the one we have today. And this one had no contradictions whatsoever, and it's even older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. This particular scroll, the first two chapters of the book of Leviticus, has consonants. Early Hebrew texts didn't specify vowels that are identical to those of the Masoretic texts. And so, just another example of what's going on over there, and it's just fascinating. They're going to use this technology to do some more of the scrolls they found in those caves, and then 300 carbonized scrolls from Herculaneum. That was the city in the Roman Empire that was totally buried in ash after a volcano erupted. And so they're going to use that technology for that purpose as well. So I thought that was just fascinating. On the back of your sheet, I have included for you a summary of all these different books that we've gone through, the date they think they were written, and half of these we went over last week. The ones in yellow I went over last week, and I'll cover the ones in white here today. Starting with 1st Esdras. Now, what does that sound like, Esdras? What other book of the Bible? Actually, there are two you could think of that it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Esdras is Greek for Ezra. And so this book, and there's a 2nd Esdras. Obviously, if there's a 1st Esdras, that leads you to believe there is a second one. But this has 9 chapters. It's considered canon by the Greek Orthodox Church, but the Catholics, it's kind of an appendix to the Vulgate. Anyone know what the Vulgate is? Written by Jerome. And this was the first Latin copy of the Bible. They translated it into Latin. And so, you know, the Catholics don't consider it canon, but they have it in their as an appendix in their first Bible. It contains most of Ezra, it contains parts of 2 Chronicles, and parts of Nehemiah. And it also adds a story. So it's very similar to those three books. And remember, Chronicles was written by Ezra. But they add a little story about three of King Darius' bodyguards. I don't know if it's Darius or Darius. Darius sounds more proper. And these three bodyguards are arguing over the one thing that is strongest. And they just decide to, I guess it's a, you know, kind of a slow work day. So they have this debate about what is the strongest. And they have this argument before the king, and it's a contest. The king will bestow a wish upon whoever is able to persuade him that the thing they mention is the strongest thing. So the first bodyguard says, well, wine is the strongest thing because it weakens anybody who drinks too much of it. Okay, that makes sense. Second bodyguard said, obviously the ultimate suck-up of all the bodyguards here, saying, well, the king is the strongest because whatever the king says, it's so. You know, the king, you are the strongest, and while the third guy's going, I'll be thinking of my prize, of course. And the third bodyguard, whose name was Zerubbabel, another name I love to say, and it is the Zerubbabel of our Old Testament. First, he says women are the strongest because women make wine and women make all of us. You know, a woman made the king, and we would be nowhere without women. Apparently, he thought the queen might have had some say into who the winner would be. I don't know. But then, right in the middle of this dialogue, he changes his mind and says, actually, the truth is the strongest thing. And I'll have a quote from that later on, but Zerubbabel is declared the winner. He's promised whatever he asks of the king, and he says, okay, king, I want you to honor your promise to us and help us and let us go back to Jerusalem and take the remnants of the temple that were carried away. Let us take them back home and rebuild. And that's exactly what happened according to this story that's added to 1 Esdras. And these passages concerning the greatness of truth were often quoted in the early church. Here's what Zerubbabel said. Wine is unrighteous, the king is unrighteous, women are unrighteous, all human beings are unrighteous, all their works and all such things. There's no truth in them, and in their unrighteousness they will perish. But truth endures and is strong forever and lives and prevails forever and ever. So that's the one addition to the book of 1 Esdras. And at the end, I'll get into why a lot of these books were not considered canon. I almost said kosher. I guess that would apply too. Okay, 2 Esdras, not really written in the same vein as the first, but it's more apocalyptic in tone. There are two Christian chapters added at the beginning and two at the end. There are 16 chapters total in this book. And it's apocalyptic. There are visions revealed to people about what will happen in the end times, or visions. Something apocalyptic is something where things are supernaturally revealed to you of biblical or deep spiritual things. And most of this is a dialogue between Ezra and an archangel named Uriel. We get a lot of names of angels in the Apocrypha. So if you were questioning what some names were, look no further than the Apocrypha. Looking for my name, I couldn't find it anywhere. But these are some of the passages in 2 Esdras that talk about some things you find elsewhere in the Bible. Talk about original sin. First Adam burdened with an evil heart, transgressed and was overcome. My son the Messiah. Now let's look at this second one, the divine Messiah. For my son the Messiah shall be revealed with those who are with him, and those who remain shall rejoice 400 years. Off by a little bit. After those years, my son the Messiah shall die, and all who draw human breath. This passage probably indicates that 2 Esdras was not written by a Christian. All who draw him, everyone, the Messiah shall die. Well, that part, they got right, but the resurrection is a kind of a minor detail they omitted from that. Judgment Day, a lot of things there that that we would believe. Also, verses on resurrection of the dead. Hell as a place of damnation for the wicked. No one is worthy of salvation. Now, there are other verses in here too, and I want to bring this up as to why we have a problem with this book. And it pertains to this vision of an eagle and a lion. There are a lot of references to an eagle and a lot of references to an eagle that grows three heads. And a lot of historians say that it's not really anything in Ezra's time. But the person who wrote this is really talking about how the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, and the three heads were the three Roman emperors, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, who were responsible for that. Those were the three heads, and the eagle, of course, if you've seen any kind of a movie with ancient Roman, if they've got the eagle with the SPQR, and it's like a big symbol of the Roman Empire. So that's one of the more interesting symbols found in that book that are kind of a red flag. Any questions so far? Because now I'm getting them a trivia question. All right. Trivia question pertains to Greek Esther. These books that I'm covering this week are additions to existing Old Testament books, a lot of them. And the Greeks decided to tack on about six chapters to the book of Esther. Here is my question. Ready? Okay. Why did the author of the Greek additions to Esther write them? Was it because the author wanted to add references to God in Esther? Was it because they wanted to cast the Persians in a better light? Was it because they wanted to add Greek philosophy to the story or to add Greek gods to the story? Why do you think? D? Who said A first? Oh, okay, well, I'll tell you what. The answer is A. There, I'll give these to you. But there is a consolation prize. I don't want to toss these anymore. Last week, what holiday did we discuss? Well, last week. Hanukkah. Because in the Maccabees, that is how, that's where we get the story of how Hanukkah originated. In Esther, there is another Jewish holiday that they mention as a celebration of the fact that, Esther and Mordecai were able to spare the Jewish people from destruction by the evil Haman. And what holiday is that? That's Purim. And as it turned out, Purim this year was March 11th. And they celebrate that by... they read the story of Esther, and they're supposed to drink every time they mention Haman, right? Or anytime they mention Mordecai, or anytime they mention anything. And they get so drunk, it's like the drinking game when you know, not that I would know. But anyway, it's by the time they are done reading the story of Esther, and you're supposed to cheer whenever they mention Mordecai, and you're supposed to boo when they mention Haman, by the time the story is done, everyone is so drunk, they just boo the wrong person, and they cheer the wrong person. And it's also marked by gifts and candy and all that sort of thing. So I missed Purim last week, but I figured in the spirit of Purim, and because I'm in a festive mood anyway with turning older tomorrow, just take the bag and pass it around and everybody grab something. Yay! Yay. This is like The Hobbit, where the guy who has the birthday gives presents to everyone else. I mean, come on. Okay. This is a quote about the additions to Esther that I thought was helpful. The Hebrew Esther is canonical for Jews and Protestants. In the Roman Catholic and Greek and Russian Orthodox churches, the expanded Greek version is the canonical form. The canonical status of Esther was debated in antiquity among Jews and Christians. It's the only book in our Bible not represented among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and indeed the revised and expanded version of Esther was most likely produced to make the book more acceptable. They added God or Lord 50 times in the Greek edition to Esther, because God's not mentioned once. You know, the whole deliverance is credited to Esther and her chutzpah, if I could insert a Yiddish word in there. Yes?
So are they added in just these additional chapters?
Or did they sprinkle God in? The question is added in the text of what we know as Esther, or it's all in the additions is where God is added. How many of you have heard of the contemporary Christian musician Aaron Jeffrey? Jeffrey is spelled J-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. He wrote a song called He Is, and it goes through all the books of the Bible and talks about in Genesis, He is the breath of life. In Exodus, He is the Passover lamb. In Leviticus, He's our high priest. In Numbers, the fire by night. He goes through, it's a beautiful song, and he talks about God in all 66 books. And when he gets to Esther, I was kind of curious of where he would go with that, and he said the lyrics say, in Esther, he's Mordecai's courage. That's the best he could do, I guess, because there's nothing really overtly in there about God. This is a picture of the Megillah. This is the scroll of Esther with the story of Esther that they read every Purim. But, like I said, God or Lord is mentioned over 50 times. Our book of Esther ends chapter 10, verse 3. It's a pretty short chapter. I think Esther 8... 9 is the longest verse in the Bible, in the whole thing. So these additions to Esther make up Esther 10:4 to 16:24. And it adds a dream that Mordecai has. It adds prayers of him and Esther. It adds two of the king's edicts and a story of Esther before the king. Now, I kind of don't have a problem with this theologically, but except for that minor detail you're not supposed to add. It's one of the last verses in Revelation. So there goes any chance I would have to approve this. But this is Greek Esther. Now remember, in our version of Esther, the canonical biblical version of Esther, you know, it's all because of Esther that this is done. But look how they changed it. When she goes before the king, lifting his face flushed with splendor, he looked at her in fierce anger. The queen faltered and turned pale and faint and collapsed on the head of the maid who went in front of her. Then God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness. God changed the spirit of the king to gentleness. And in alarm, he sprang from his throne and took her in his arms until she came to herself. He comforted her with soothing words. So that is the main change, along with some of the edicts and prayers and things that I mentioned in that one. Any questions on that? I don't think it says God. Maybe you might have said we or something like some other.
I don't remember exactly, but I remember saying God, but I just, you know, you just think you understood.
Right. God is implied, if not stated outright.
Not stated, it's implied.
Okay. Baruch. Baruch is one of the additions to the book of Jeremiah. Baruch was considered Jeremiah's secretary or scribe. And there's actually, I believe he's actually mentioned in the book of Jeremiah as being associated with Jeremiah. Baruch is mentioned in the Bible. Yet again, like most of these, most likely written in the 2nd century BC by an unknown Jewish author, which makes me want to think it's pseudepigrapha, because you tack on someone's name and they didn't really write it, but they call it apocrypha. Some of these are interchangeable. I read this again last night, and if you close your eyes, actually you don't have to close your eyes, but if you've read anything of these Old Testament prophets, and then I read you Baruch, you would think, okay, that passes. That sounds a lot like an Old Testament prophet. Okay, they got the doom and gloom. Yeah, check. They got the other things, and it sounds a lot like that. In the Episcopal Church, they read part of Baruch on Christmas Eve because it talks about the coming of a Messiah. Some early translations, like the Vulgate, say that God appeared on earth and lived with humankind. So they make no distinction between God the Father and God the Son. And then they translated it later as wisdom appeared on earth and lived with mankind. I had this list. I didn't get it up on a slide, but there are a lot of verses in the Gospels that compare very much with a lot of the Baruch verses. Yes?
So are the prophets, prophecies that fulfills.
I will read to you. I'll read to you the passage that I mentioned here. And let's see, Baruch 4. Okay, here's what this says, Baruch. Yeah, it's very generic. Be of good cheer, O my children. Cry unto the Lord, and He will deliver you from the power and hand of the enemies. For my hope is in the everlasting, that He will save you, and joy is come unto me from the Holy One. Because of the mercy which shall soon come unto you from the everlasting our Savior. For I sent you out with mourning and weeping, but God will give you to me again with joy and gladness forever. Like as now the neighbors of Zion have seen your captivity, so shall they see shortly. God. This might not have been much of a tongue twister in Hebrew as it is in English. But surely thou shalt see his destruction and shalt tread upon his neck. Be of good comfort, O my children, and cry unto God, for ye shall be remembered of him that brought these things upon you. So it's very vague. But that is, you know, they can take that and say, they're talking about, these are cryptic Messiah verses. Which brings us to, is there anything left in that bag? Are we making our way around it? I didn't tell my kids about the bag, so if you want to, you know... There's also a letter or an epistle of Jeremiah, also known as the 6th chapter of Baruch, written from the 3rd century. You know, this is a wide time frame when this could have been written. And this was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, this particular letter. It's one chapter long, and I'm going to get into that later when I discuss the red flags. Now, this is one of the more interesting books of the whole Apocrypha. The Book of Susanna. And this was in addition to the book of Daniel. This is considered Daniel chapter 13. Our Daniel ends at chapter 12. This is considered in their book, in their Bible, Daniel chapter 13. And another name I found here was Celsius, C-H-E-L-C-I-A-S, like Celsius except with an H. And Celsius was the name of Susanna's father. It was also the name of Baruch's father. It was the name of the high priest in Baruch's father. So Celsius, for some reason, just is a name in this brief period of time. And then poof, it's gone. You don't read about it anymore. But it's considered canon. And here's the story. I think these people just pick Daniel as their blank slate and give all these heroic stories to Daniel. Apparently, there was this woman, beautiful woman named Susanna, and she is married to a very wealthy and very prominent Jew named Joachim, or Joachim. I can't Latinize that name. It's probably Joachim, I guess. And one day, she's in the garden, walking around, and these two very lecherous old men have been spying on her for a long time, and they don't want to admit that they're lusting after her. And finally, when they both catch each other doing the peeping Joachim thing or whatever, then they admit their desire to each other, and they hatch this plot. They get her alone, and they try to persuade. They try to persuade her to sleep with them, or else they are going to spread this rumor that she was with the younger man. And she's thinking, well, I'm doomed either way, so I might as well do this with a clear conscience and not do anything wrong. If I'm going to be accused, I'm going to be wrongfully accused. Turns the old men down, and the old men spread this rumor. We caught her with a younger man. And so everyone, of course, believes the elders, and so they sentence her to death. And she cries out, why am I being persecuted like this without any chance to try to defend myself or explain myself? And just when it seems like she will be executed, here comes a young man by the name of Daniel and saves the day. And what he does is he gathers this crowd together and separates the two elders so he can talk to one and then the other. And it's like Daniel as an Old Testament Columbo. You know, picture him in the overcoat. Now, before I leave, I have one more question for you. Something that's bothered me a little bit here. Now, you say that you caught her and this younger man. What tree did you see them together in? Daniel even sounds like Peter Falk. That's kind of interesting. What tree did you spot them in? And the first elder said, well, it was a mastiff tree. Okay? Now, this is a mastiff tree. I do this to give you the size, the sense of scale. Okay, thank you very much. So they take him out, and they bring in the second elder, and they ask the second elder, okay, what tree did you see Susanna and this young man? And he said it was a holm tree, which is a kind of an oak. Nowhere near the size of the other tree, as you can see here from that. So Daniel was able to save the day and spare her from execution, and instead the two elders were put to death. Now, this story was frequently painted by the Renaissance artists because, you know, it's a seduction scene. They're going to, you know, Susanna and Bathsheba, they love to paint those two in the Renaissance days. I was going to put a picture up here, but there wasn't a decent one to be found. So, we're all grown-ups, but you never know. Rubens, Rembrandt, even Picasso later on painted Susanna. Handel, the composer, wrote an oratorio about her. The American artist Thomas Hart Benton painted a modern Susanna. And the fable of Susanna here was set during the Depression. He included himself as one of the two dirty elders, which I thought was interesting. I think the other elder was from Alabama and had a banjo on his knee. Shakespeare talks about this in The Merchant of Venice. Portia was praised as being a second Daniel because of her sound judgment. Shakespeare named one of his daughters Susanna. named another one Judith, of another Apocrypha book. Then we get to my favorite book of the whole Apocrypha, it's my personal favorite, Bel and the Dragon. And this is considered Daniel chapter 14, 42 verses long. It contains two different stories. The first one is about this god Bel, or Baal, sounds like. It's really probably the Babylonian god Marduk. But, Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, isn't this statue, isn't this god great? Look at this. We put food before this god every night, and we come in the next morning, and the food's gone. This god can eat and consume this food and drink that we set before him. You should worship this thing, this god. And Daniel just laughs, which doesn't make Nebuchadnezzar feel very good, laughing at him and saying, okay, let's just put this to the test. And so they have about 70 people who are in charge of this statue and feeding it every night, and the wives and children. So they set the food before this statue, and they're going to lock up the temple for the night, and the king is going to seal it with his signet ring. And Daniel said, after they all had fed the statue and left, Daniel said, hold on a second, king, watch this. So he gets some ashes and just pours them all over the floor. So next morning, they come in, unlock the door. Sure enough, all the food is gone. And the king is telling Daniel, see, this is just proof that this God is real. And Daniel just points to the ground, and you see about 70 sets of footprints of men, women, and children all around where the food was, and there was a little trap door underneath the table that they had been using for this. And so they are executed. The second story, he destroys a dragon. This is a medieval rendering of this event. I don't know if this is a real giant lizard or if it's some type of an idol like Bel was, but they worshipped him and said Daniel ought to do the same. Daniel gets this nasty concoction of pitch and hair and tar and whatnot and stuffs these things into the mouth of this thing, and it blows up, it bursts, proving that this is not such a great God after all. And that gets them upset. So what do? They condemn Daniel to a lion's den. Okay? And this is has other things like the prophet Habakkuk is transported, an angel grabs him by the hair of his head and drags him hundreds of miles to where Daniel is to minister to him. Daniel is spared again. He's in the lion's den for about 5 or 6 days or 7 days. But just a couple of very interesting stories in that one. And then finally in Daniel, this is added toward the beginning, prayer of Azariah, the song of the three, I spelled that wrong, three young men. Azariah is Abednego. And it's inserted into Daniel chapter 3, where it talks about how they gave praise to the Lord for delivering them. It's used in Christian worship as the Benedicite in the Episcopal services. Now, what's interesting to me about this is that in the middle of the fiery furnace ordeal, Azariah, Abednego, manages to pray a 22-verse prayer acknowledging Israel's unfaithfulness, and he doesn't get around to asking God for help until verse 20. That would kind of be toward the front of mine if I were doing this. So after they are rescued, they break into what's called the Song of the Three Young Men, the Three Children, 40 verses of singing praise to God, and then, you would think it was from Psalms if I read it to you. And then it ends with praise to God coming from the mouth of the ungodly king of Babylon. But there aren't any verses of them the three thanking him afterwards, God afterwards, which I thought was interesting. The last two I mentioned before I get to the red flags section, the prayer of Manasseh. Turn to 2 Chronicles real quick. Chapter 33. Again, 2 Chronicles written by Ezra. So this is another, I kind of call this another Ezra version. What do we know about Manasseh? He was bad. He was probably the most wicked of them all, according to Scripture. But who was his father? Does anyone know who his father was?
Hezekiah,
who was a good guy, pretty much. So let's read verses 10 through 13. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they paid no attention. You can copy and paste that verse several places in the Old Testament without the Manasseh part. Therefore the Lord brought the commanders of the army of the king of Assyria against them, and they captured Manasseh with hooks, bound him with bronze chains, and took him to Babylon. When he was in distress, he entreated the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. When he prayed to him, God was moved by his entreaty and heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. So the purpose of this particular book of the Apocrypha is to show you what he most likely prayed in, as referred to in that passage in 2 Chronicles. And it is considered one of the greatest penitential prayers ever composed. Some people thought that it should have been canonized with the liturgy of the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. And this is just the opening passage. And now behold, I am bending the knees of my heart before you, and I am beseeching your kindness. I have sinned, O Lord, I have sinned, and I certainly know my sin. That's how it begins. A lot of Protestants, even, they really like this prayer. They don't think it's canonical, but they really do get some use out of it as a devotional type of a thing. We have now gone from being freezing cold to burning up in this room. And finally, before I get to the red flag, Psalm 151. Again, I read this, and it reads like your typical psalm. It's supposedly by David, and it's about him slaying Goliath. But like our own canonized version of Esther, it's all them and not much of God. It wasn't really, I got that notion reading Psalm 151 that David was talking about how great he was and not God did this for me. So it's pretty short, but it was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Orthodox consider it canon. That's an image of Psalm 151 that they found in the scrolls. Last week, for the red flags, I talked about a lot of theological issues. One of the verses talked about purgatory. Another one, a bunch of them talked about works righteousness. You had some about other topics, but I have two here for you today. They're not as dramatic as the ones last week, but this is a passage from Jeremiah, the letter of Jeremiah, that kind of raised the red flag with me. Because of the sins that you have committed before God, you'll be taken to Babylon as exiles by Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonians. Remember last week, one of them said he was king of the Assyrians. Therefore, when you come to Babylon, you will remain there for many years, for a long time, up to seven generations. After that, I will bring you away from there in peace. My problem with this one is that unless a generation is 10 years, it's wrong. This is one of the examples in the Apocrypha of a biblical contradiction, a contradiction with another verse, in this case a few of them, in Scripture where it explicitly says they're going to be there for 70 years, not seven generations. Just a small example, but an important one. Another one, 2 Esdras. In the 30th year after the destruction of the city, I was in Babylon. I, Salatiel, whom also called Ezra. This is an historical inaccuracy because it talks about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, not what it's claiming to talk about here, which is the destruction of Jerusalem, the first temple. It's one of those many things. You know, if we are going to claim that the Bible is the inspired, infallible Word of God, there's no place for this anywhere near our Bible. So those are just some of the red flags. So who liked it and who didn't? A couple of examples. St. Augustine said it should be on equal authority with the other books. Luther wanted to include it in the Bible, but in an appendix, There were some popes who said, you know, some of these books like Psalm 151, I don't want these to be lost entirely for history, so let's not burn them or get rid of them. Let's just stick them in the back, but not with the other books. Calvinists said shouldn't be included at all, and a lot of Reformed, of course, most of the Protestants here today say it shouldn't be included at all. You might be able to get something out of it, historically speaking, unless you don't know the difference between Babylon and Assyria, or 70 and seven generations. Skip over that part, you're okay, I think. This is very small print, sorry about that. So what is the final verdict? I got this list from one of these theological websites. There's not sufficient evidence that they were reckoned as canonical by the Jews at any time. That's kind of important. Some of the Jews might revere them, you know, after the fact, after the Old Testament, when they went into their the Talmud and commentaries and things like that. During the second century, the Alexandrian Jews adopted the Greek version of the Old Testament without these apocryphal books. I'm getting to the big one here. Number 9, Jesus and the New Testament writers never once quote the Apocrypha, although there are hundreds of quotes and references to almost the entire book, all the books of the Old Testament. Now, there's going to be one exception to this when we talk about the pseudepigrapha, because there is a book of the New Testament that quotes one of those books. And not until 1546, at the Council of Trent, did the Catholics call them apocryphal, and that was more or less to thumb their nose at the Protestants, people believe. So that is the Apocrypha in a huge 2-week nutshell. Does anybody have any questions about any of that? Did anybody get enough candy? All right, well, I'll see you in a couple of weeks then, and we'll talk about those the testaments of Noah and Abraham that were written by Tom, Dick, and Harry. So, see you then.